smartest mind, the smartest mind, whose world is this?
You're listening to Asheville FM at WSFM LP 103.3 Asheville. Following the murder of George Floyd by police in Minneapolis last May, larger groups of people internationally are expressing how communities' needs are not being met by current public safety configurations. This has led to increasingly mainstream discussions of what our communities might look like with police abolition, police reform, or budgets that reallocate funding typically towards the police, towards community-named needs. In Asheville, for example, some community-named needs raised amidst budget draftings for the city have included calls for a fully funded transit master plan, a pay raise for firefighters, the removal of Confederate monuments, and calls to cut the APD budget by half and reinvest the money in Asheville's Black community. One petition connected to the local newspaper, The Urban News, argues that money set to fund the Asheville Police Department could better address community needs by creating a new city department of peace and well-being, tasked with the care and safety of people and communities, something sometimes expected of the police but not necessarily received. Under this new department, the petition states, there could be new roles to support the peace of the city and the well-being of its residents. It could provide unarmed support teams, which could be dispatched at a moment's notice. Thoughts include a team of social workers, counselors, mediators, negotiators to support individuals and families, a team trained in domestic violence response, neighborhood leaders who could be hired and trained to be peer support mediators, people assigned to handle the flow and safety of traffic, human and civil rights observers regarding housing and employment, services for healing stress and trauma, and an allocation of funds to invest in current and the incubation of African American and Latinx owned businesses, equitable economic and educational opportunities, living wage jobs, affordable housing, transportation, and poverty remediation. This acts as a sort of list of needs the crafters hope for and assumedly don't see in our police force or city government currently. Looking beyond Asheville, one recent example of funding reallocation has been in Austin, Texas, where the community decided to redirect funds to support women's health care following public outrage to the murder of George Floyd. Other cities have reduced police budgets and made promises for reform that we will watch over the next years. The focus of today's broadcast comes from another example I learned of when speaking with local Asheville drummer Matt Shepard. He described to me how emergency medical services in the United States prior to the late 1960s were often provided by police departments and not the well-equipped EMS teams, ambulances, that we think of today. In 1966, following a health research publication often referred to as the 1966 White Paper, it was noted that inadequately trained police, inappropriately designed, and ill-equipped paddy wagons resulted in high numbers of unnecessary death. In fact, 50% of ambulance services nationwide were being provided by morticians, collecting dead bodies, not providing trauma care. This all changed with an interesting project which emerged in 1967 out of Pittsburgh. Dr. Peter Saffer of Presbyterian Hospital in Pittsburgh, and the creator of CPR, collaborated with a community center in the predominantly Black Hill District of Pittsburgh to create the model of our current EMS system. This project was called Freedom House. In an effort to create meaningful work and respond to the lack of trauma care offered by police, Freedom House addressed community needs by developing a program of ambulances and trained paramedics to meet those needs. Tragically, the city's mayor took over the program, pushed out much of the original successful Black EMS team, and took credit for their work. Even so, the model developed by that original team of Freedom House provided the grounds of the emergency health care response model that we now take for granted, while until 2009, the story of Freedom House had been all but erased, Gene Starzynski created a documentary telling this story, which is now being negotiated as the base of a streaming miniseries. Gene, a career medical worker, originally from Pittsburgh and now out of California, is here with me today to talk about the story of Freedom House. Thanks for being here with me, Gene.
Hey, Andrew. Well, thank you for having me on your show, and thanks to all the people there in Nashville and throughout the country that want to hear this one, about Freedom House.
So you yourself lived in Pittsburgh and also have been able to interview a number of Freedom House participants to make your documentary. I wonder, from all of those perspectives, can you tell me what emergency services looked like in Pittsburgh in the 60s?
Well, I grew up in Pittsburgh in the 50s and 60s, and I do remember probably, in my 12 years old or 13 or something like that, I saw it, but the police did. The police had paddy wagons. And basically, what they were is that there was a certain paddy wagons were designed for picking up patients, but they were also used for the jails, too. So the only thing they had in there was a metal bench, and they had an army cot, and some carried an oxygen bottle. I got to see first up when I was like about 12, 13 years old, because my grandfather, we had a little function at my house, and my grandfather went to walk downstairs, and he fell down the steps, and he split his head open. So he was bleeding pretty bad. As being a young kid, it kind of shook me up seeing, all the blood and my grandfather laying there, And we took a towel and just put it on his head. And the police showed up with their paddy wagon, and they didn't do anything. The only thing they did is they took our towel that we had and held it on his head and took him to the hospital that way. Thank God my grandfather survived. But a lot of people during those times didn't survive because they didn't have much training, and there was nothing in those paddy wagons but, like I mentioned, a bench and basically an army cot. And like I said, a few had oxygen bottles, and some had first aid training, some didn't. And most of the time, they didn't even sit in the back there with you. They both sat up front, and they just transported you to the hospital. It was rudimentary, most medical care in the United States. I mean, there were some that were given by fire departments, I understand, and a lot were done by police departments. And see, the police took pride in working on those paddy wagons because that was the only job function that, the people from the city would give them honor. It was like an honor to do that job, even though they weren't doing it right or doing it correctly. At least it was something that the people looked up to them for. So what happened was, there's a depressed area in Pittsburgh called the Hill District, and they weren't getting much medical care up there. In fact, they said the paddy wagon police ambulances would save them for last. And the only other medical transportation was funeral homes. And they had like a Cadillac-type hearse and another Cadillac that was made into an ambulance. The only difference between the two was, the one had like a gurney that they would put a dead body on, and the other one was more of a cot, and it had a red light, and they would take you to the hospital. And the only thing they had was like an oxygen bottle also. And some people used to say it was one-stop shopping, because if you happened to get the private ambulance, which was the funeral homes, if they picked you up and you were deceased, they would just run you to the hospital where the doctor would just come out of the emergency room and pronounce you dead, and then they'd just take your body to the funeral home right after that. So kind of what was happening back then.
So in the ambulances, it sounds like really a roll of the die about whether you would have any treatment at all, whether the people picking you up had first aid training, whether or not you would survive.
Well, it would tell you the story that I was told was, they used to put the patient in, feet first, so that the body would be sticking towards the back doors. So they just opened up the back doors and the doctor come out and pronounce them dead. In fact, Dr. Saffer, who was the one who helped start Freedom House, was actually an inventor of CPR and everything. He actually redesigned the ambulances as they are today. But that was a feature back in those days. They used to say that they put you in feet first, so it was easy for the doctor just to come out and pronounce you dead.
So the private ambulances at the funeral homes, for example, would they ever be used to pick up people, or it would always be the police paddy wagons?
For emergencies, it was the police paddy wagons. The ambulances were usually, at the funeral home, and a lot of funeral homes are basically in the community. And if you live close by, and you knew the funeral home director, you could call them, and they would respond after that ambulance and take you to the hospital. There were some suburbs later on when I was working in the emergency room in Pittsburgh in 1971. There were some suburbs that had volunteer-type ambulances, and they would bring you to the hospital. But like I said, they didn't have much as far as equipment in there, and the training was from the suburbs was basic first aid training.
If you're just joining in, I'm speaking with Gene Straczynski, career medical worker and director of the film Freedom House, Street Saviors. We've been talking about the lack of effective EMS
prior to the late 1960s, often provided by police departments, and not the well-equipped EMS teams, ambulances, that we think of today.
So can you tell me a little bit more about how you came in touch with Freedom House and how it changed EMS response?
I left Pittsburgh and joined the Marine Corps in 1969, and I was out of the Marine Corps in 1970. So when I came out, I went to school of police science and community college. See, I was already doing police work, so it was hard because when I got out of the service, I couldn't get a job because you had to be 21 in those days to be a police officer. That's why I went to school. So I got, you know, displeased about it all, and I kind of left college and then I had to decide what to do with my life. And, you know, someone mentioned to me, take a first aid course, try to get a job on a private ambulance. And I thought, you know, what the hell? I went and took a Red Cross first aid course. And, you know, there weren't many private ambulance companies at all. Like I said, the police ambulances in Pittsburgh were the ones that transported emergency patients. And I found one that wasn't funeral home connected. I finally got a job. And so what happened was is we would go out on basic transport calls, you know, non-emergency. So we would show up to the hospital. And when I was working in 1971, we had a Cadillac ambulance and an Oldsmobile ambulance. No vans, none of that. And I would see this van at the hospital and said Freedom House on it. And they were all African Americans that worked there. And I would look in the back of, and look at the equipment, and I went, holy cow. It looked like a ICU, advanced life support equipment. And I used to ask the guys that I worked with, there was just a few of us, all about Freedom House. I said, who are these guys, you know? And they came out of a hospital called Presbyterian Hospital. And that hospital was a leading hospital in training. In fact, the Salk vaccine came out of that hospital. Later on, they did the first liver transplant. I mean, it was a well-renowned hospital. And the guys I worked with told me that they were just a bunch of hoods, you know, because they're all African-Americans. You know, and they used the N-word, and they said that's all they do is hold crap games at the station. They rule people in the back of those ambulances. And I knew it wasn't true, but I didn't get to see the guys when they were at the hospital, and I really wanted to meet up and find out more about them. Then later on, after I left the ambulance company, I got a job working in the south side of Pittsburgh in the emergency room. So I worked in there as an orderly, and then about a year later, I was moved up to ER technician. And Freedom House would come into my hospital. So I was given an opportunity to talk to them and find out more about Freedom House. And that's what propelled me to do the story about them.
What did you end up learning?
Freedom House started in 67, and they operated from 67 to 75. So this is 71 when I got to meet them. If you walked in one of their ambulances in 1971 and walked in a modern-day ambulance today, you'd see the same type of equipment, just different models, you know, more updated, miniaturized, you know, but the same type of equipment with the communications and the burn kits and the IV and the drugs and everything else is all this. They had it all in there. So I talked to them and got to know some of them, and I wanted to find out how to join up with them. And they said that there was a doctor over Presbyterian Hospital, Dr. Peter Saffer, and I could give him a call and find out more about it.
If you're just joining in, I'm speaking with Gene Straczynski, career medical worker and director of the film Freedom House, Street Saviors. We've been talking about the creation of Freedom House, which birthed our modern EMS. Notably, this project was run and developed in Pittsburgh's Black community in the Hill District and created a model of emergency response that met the community's needs better than the police force had previously been able to by providing trained and appropriate levels of care. Let's take a look now at some of the people involved at the beginning of this story.
It's like the founders and everything, how it all came together.
First, there's Jim McCoy,
a steel worker who works in the community center in the Hill District called Freedom House Enterprise.
It was like a community center. It was a nonprofit to help black people find jobs, help them register to vote, and organize the NAACP meetings when the civil rights movement was in full swing.
Then there's Jim's friend, Philip Hallen, who is the president of a local charity.
Because he had an access to the bigger money in Pittsburgh.
There's Phil's friend, Morton Coleman, who was at the time working for the somewhat sympathetic mayor, Joe Barr, and knew about federal money coming in with the poverty initiatives.
There was this poverty program during the civil rights movement. There was monies that were given to help people in the disadvantaged neighborhoods, especially the African-American communities, to train people into different careers, different jobs. And some of them were called like the Manpower Development Act, and some of them were called like the federal government's war on poverty.
Then there's Jerry Esposito.
He had a company called Citizens Ambulance, and they were in the Indiana, Pennsylvania.
Home of Jimmy Stewart, about an hour out of Pittsburgh.
So he wanted to find out from other people in the community what they were doing, you know, were they getting trained? Was there any training to take? Then he found out about Dr. Saffer.
The group found Dr. Saffer after Phil Hallen reached out to Ed Norian, the Presbyterian Hospital Administrator.
Dr. Saffer, he ran the anesthesiology department there, and he was just developed CPR. And he was actually influential with the white paper in 1966.
Which is a document entitled Accidental Death and Disability, the Neglected Disease of Modern Society.
There's more people dying on the streets of America than there were in the war in Vietnam. That was a white, it was called the white paper.
Fueled in part by surgeons with military experience in Korea and World War II, who recognized the trauma care available to soldiers overseas was better than the care available in local communities. After the white paper was released, it also inspired EMT curriculum and the DOT's offering of grant funding to states for them to improve their EMS.
And the government came to Dr. Saffer and asked him to help them, assist them in getting a training program together. And in the meantime, Dr. Saffer was also created the Reassess Annie. He was using that to train people to do CPR. So they got together with Dr. Saffer, so like five of them. They had this little meeting group, and that's how all these heads got together, and it came up with this program. It's crazy. I mean, it all happened like quickly, you know? One person knew somebody, knew somebody, knew somebody, and they put this program together.
Wow.
And they had the federal monies, you know?
So some of this is grant money from the DOT. That's for EMT training. And then some of it is for paying wages, et cetera, to the workers. And that part is a mixture of federal money related to the supposed war on poverty and, I guess, donations that were collected, as you were saying, from Phil Hallen's connections. Can you talk about that?
That federal monies I told you about that were coming to train African-Americans in the community was more or less money to keep African-Americans quiet. Here, we're going to give you 2 years. We're going to give you some money to train you. We'll give you 2 years, and we know you're going to fail. And you're going to come back to us, and you're going to say, do you need more money? You need this? We're going to say, hey, listen, we try to help you, but, you know, you failed on your own. So this was always a program that was kind of meant to fail, but it didn't. It became bigger than they thought because of the people that were behind it. You had Dr. Saffer that was trying to showcase CPR, and he wanted to bring it to the community. And Dr. Saffer's philosophy was to bring the care to the patient. Not the patient to the care. And that's what he did. And when he got involved in Freedom House, that was his vehicle to bring the care to the patient. So these people weren't going to let it fail. Then you have Phil Hallen, and you have Morton Coleman, and you had Jim McCoy. And when the funds were running low, they had people in the community that they knew who the wealthy benefactors were. And they would go there and get some money off them to keep the program running.
So because this is happening during like the civil rights movement and there's a lot of demonstrations, is this like a way of trying to be like, hey, look, we did something without the intention of it succeeding? Just explicit racism. Why do you think they wanted it to fail?
Well, the men, too. The men, were they considered them, if you read any articles about them, they called them hardcore unemployables. And, I mean, a lot of these guys were taken off the street. Some did have, you know, medical backgrounds or just got out of service or medics. And the thing of it is they didn't want the program to fail. They actually trained them at the hospital. So that was going to be a little different, too, because Now you have all the doctors and nurses coming in there, and they weren't too happy about these African-American guys training at their hospital. And Dr. Saffer was such a big status there that he just stepped in and said, no, I'm not going to hear it. These men are training, and you're going to help them. And that's what he did with his foot down.
Notably, Dr. Peter Saffer was born and raised in Vienna, Austria, where he lived until he was 25, and may as such not have had quite the same buy-in to the white supremacy culture of the United States.
And then when he went out on the calls and people respecting them, it gave them a job that they were proud of. I mean, you know, they couldn't even buy a meal. They would go to the local place for lunch and, you know, and everybody would want to buy their meals. And they were really tight in the community. Like I said, they knew everybody because, they, you know, some of them grew up there. The others grew up in the north side, but they would do anything for anyone. So those are things that you don't hear of today. You know, they don't hear about that at all. But they respected everyone in the community, and they gave their all to the community. And they did excellent work.
Do you have a sense of how that model traveled to other cities after it took root in Pittsburgh?
Well, I know that Dr. Saffer took the men to New York. He'd go talk, and he actually took them to New York, and they actually speak and train people in New York. He took them when he went overseas, and from what I understand, there's people that know about Freedom House all over the world from what they've done. There was a doctor that came in much later. Her name was Dr. Nancy Caroline, and she was going to be training under Dr. Saffer to take that emergency room physician's course. And Dr. Saffer, since he didn't have a lot of time now, that he actually put her in the Freedom House and let her take over the program. And she actually ran calls with the men. She lived and breathed Freedom House. They used to tell her to go home sometimes because, you know, she would just stay at the station and stay there all constantly. And she actually learned from Freedom House. She learned a lot about emergency medicine from seeing what Freedom House did, that when Freedom House got disbanded in 1975, she went to Israel and started the Mogen Dah, which is the paramedic program in Israel, from what she learned from Freedom House. And they call her today the mother of paramedics.